Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, two conversations about air pollution. A little bit later in the show, we'll hear about how much cleaner, at least here in northern Utah, our air has been because of the impacts of the pandemic, and what we might learn and later apply from the difficult moment in history we're living through. First, though, a new study in the journal Environmental Research examines the distribution of air pollution in Salt Lake County, and particularly how the levels of pollution vary between schools across the county. The findings of the study show a disproportionate exposure to air pollution in schools with predominantly minority students and students from low-income households. Sarah Groneski is a professor of sociology and environmental studies at the University of Utah. She was the senior author of that paper. I got her on a Zoom call earlier this week to hear more about her study, about the effects of PM 2.5 particulate pollution on childhood development, and more. Sarah Groneski, thanks for making time for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So to begin with, I think I'll just ask how the data for this study was collected. How were you measuring air pollution, and where were you measuring it?
Sure, yeah. The air pollution data for the study came from the AQ&U partnership, which is located at the University of Utah. And it's a group of engineers and computer scientists and electrical engineers, chemical engineers, who basically have monitors spread out throughout the county. So we relied on monitors from about 200 different air quality sensors. These are low-cost sensors that people have in their homes or, you know, outside of their homes. Some of the sensors are located at schools. And so instead of relying on the Utah Department of Air Quality monitors, which there's only a couple in the county, we use this distributed sensor network, this community university partnership. And so we were able to get really fine scale spatial as well as temporal measurements of air pollution.
Temporal. It occurs to me that's a question that I should ask as well, is when were you measuring this? What, you know, air quality circumstances were you looking at?
Sure. One of the things about the paper that's unique is we actually compared patterns of social inequality and exposure at the schools between three different scenarios: a relatively clean day, a moderate winter inversion, and a major winter inversion. So we use these 10-minute increments of air quality measures across three 48-hour periods, one representing each of those three scenarios. So we were able to look and see if patterns of environmental injustice or social inequalities and exposure change depending on the weather conditions that are shaping our PM exposure.
I mentioned in my introduction, and you just pointed it out right now, that inequitable exposure to pollution. Can you tell us the sort of summary of findings of your research?
Definitely. So the goal of the study was to compare social inequalities in exposures at the public schools in Salt Lake County between these three different scenarios. And one finding that we found across all three scenarios was that schools that serve higher concentrations of racial ethnic minority students have significantly higher levels of PM 2.5 exposure, whether the air is relatively clean, we have a moderate inversion, or we have a major inversion. So we used two variables to assess racial ethnic status at the schools, and those variables were statistically significant in all three scenarios. So that illustrates sort of the durability of that inequality, no matter whether the air is pretty good, although still health harming, a new evidence suggesting that PM's health harming at even low levels, to the really, you know, major inversion.
I mean, yeah, we talk about the green level or good air quality. I say it on the radio sometimes. And again, there's no healthy level of PM 2.5.
No,
exposure.
The science is, you know, coming to that conclusion now that PM is health harming at nearly every level or all levels. And then we also found when air pollution was relatively clean or moderate, we saw an SES or a socioeconomic status based pattern, whereby the Title I schools were exposed to significantly higher levels of PM when the air was relatively clean and when the air, well, we were experiencing a moderate inversion. In the major inversion scenario, the effect was still positive. There were still higher levels of PM in Title I schools, but it wasn't statistically significant anymore.
I get it. Okay, so that means that the inequity that you're describing in your study is more pronounced on days where the air quality was, you know, quote unquote, better across the board meaning they had comparatively worse air quality on so-called green air days. You mean that's comparatively better as compared to other schools that you're—
that are not Title I, right? Okay, so the Title I variable is the school is either a Title I school or it's not. And so when we say that the Title I school has significantly higher levels of PM, that's in comparison to all the schools that are not Title I, that are not serving the low-income community in the same way.
Are you able to say why that gap is there? I mean, is it geographic location? What's the explanation? Or maybe what do you think the explanation might be if you don't? I know it's hard. You get the data, you look at it, you say, here's what we can see, but the whys are harder to determine, right?
You're right. And our study was just cross-sectional, you know, looking at a slice of time in the recent, you know, the last 2 years. But in terms of reasons for why we find especially the racial ethnic disparity, I mean, you have to look back at the history of the development of Salt Lake City. And we see the same patterns in other US cities as well, right? Sort of historical patterns of segregation with, you know, people of color being relegated to the least desirable parts of the city, right? And then segregation law sort of enforcing that. And then over time, you see cities developing, you see lower land values and rental prices and housing prices in those areas. And you also see in the Salt Lake area, this sort of elevational gradient where we have, you know, higher SES people living higher up the bench where the air quality in terms of the particulate matter is better. So you have this sort of race and class-based geography, and then the way our air pollution moves in, right? The air pollution settles, right, in the lower parts of the valley where lower income and racial ethnic minority communities.
It's social stratification mirroring geographic, stratification. Exactly. That's interesting.
Yeah, in Salt Lake Valley, it's quite pronounced, the elevational gradient in socioeconomic status as well as, you know, air quality.
Let's zoom out a little and talk about what air pollution does. It's especially problematic for kids, and that's because it has impacts on their development and I think long-term health outcomes.
Yeah, children are more sensitive to the effects of air pollution than adults. So even given the same dose, kids are more sensitive. Their body systems are still developing. They're not as able to fight off particulates. They take in more air than adults do. They spend more time outside. They're more likely to, you know, put things in their mouths. So there's all sorts of reasons why kids get greater exposure than adults. And in terms of the long-term effects of air pollution on our health, a lot of the initial literature was focused on respiratory health effects. So asthma attacks, respiratory infections, bronchitis. Research since has moved into cardiovascular effects of air pollution on health. So you see associations with spikes in pollution and heart attacks, strokes. More recent literature is focused on neurological impacts of air pollution, so how it affects the way that our brains are functioning. There's a researcher at the University of Montana who's done work in Mexico City. She's done autopsies on people who have died from traffic accidents. And she's seen, you know, changes in children's brains resembling early onset Alzheimer's disease for kids that are exposed to really high levels of air pollution in Mexico City. Some of my own research is focused on the effects of air pollution on children's academic performance, on the grades that they get in school, on how well they do on math tests. My research team, we just published a study just earlier in 2020, actually, that showed that levels of air pollution were impacting the performance of kids on math, science, and reading assessments. We used a national data set of 18,000 kids. And you see the effect of schools, kids that have higher levels of air pollution around their home and their school are doing significantly worse on their reading, science, and math tests. And that's controlling for a bunch of other factors that we know influence school performance, mother's level of education, whether the child speaks English at home, their socioeconomic status, all kinds of things. New research is showing these brain effects of air pollution. So there's all sorts of reasons why we should be really concerned about the effects of air pollution on children and children in school.
You know, are those impacts lasting or are they immediate? Meaning, is it that the air pollution on a given day impacts the student's ability to perform in school, or is it that this is a sort of developmental impact and then long-term, you know, they're not as able to bounce back, or is it both? You know what I mean?
I mean, the literature on this, it's not equivocal yet. We don't actually know, right? There are a handful of studies looking at the effects of air pollution on academic performance. And so we don't, the answer to your question is we don't know. But I think if we bring together other bodies of literature as well, I think it's probably both. The pollution is harming the way that our brains function and the speed at which they work. And there also can be test day effects where high air pollution makes it harder for us to complete, you know, cognitive tasks right now. There's research on, you know, older adults experiencing cognitive decline, and they don't do quite as well on mental assessments right when pollution is high. But I think you see both longer term effects as well as short term effects. That's a question I'm personally really interested in investigating. It's something I want to do in my research in the coming years, but it's, we don't know for sure, but it's likely, it could definitely be both.
Okay. It's a really fascinating area of research that you're involved in. And how does this data, the data that you have gathered, the results of the studies, the paper that you've published, how can this information be utilized to maybe improve the situation? Is there any sort of recommendations that you make as a researcher towards policymakers and public, you know, officials involved in making decisions about air quality?
Definitely. I mean, it's hard to say, well, what do we just do about this? How do we just fix it when these patterns are, you know, developing over the hundreds of years in which cities develop in urban space? So it's not necessarily something we can fix overnight, although there's many things we could do that could reduce the levels of air pollution in our community. And so I think the results, these injustices, definitely are another sort of piece of evidence that can be used to advocate for pollution reduction strategies. So legislation to lower the, you know, allowable PM levels, programs that bring in, you know, more electric cars and cars that, you know, especially for people that don't have the money to buy those on their own. So certainly there are legislative actions we can take to reduce air pollution. I think another policy element here is just this whole issue of school siting and environmental hazards, which doesn't get a whole lot of attention. The EPA has guidelines, very nice, you know, over 100-page PDF, really extensive guidelines. The World Health Organization has guidelines. But in the United States, we don't have a federal law specifying that schools can't be located near environmental hazards. And so some states take these things into consideration, most don't. And so I think as we site new schools, as well as make decisions about which schools to close, as certain areas have declining population, I feel like environmental hazards should be one element that's considered in those decisions. And so bringing in an environmental health person, you know, considering this as one of the variables as we site new schools and close old schools, I think is important. Thirdly, I think just ways in which we can retrofit our buildings, do a better job of keeping the air pollution out. I mean, our measures, we're looking at outside air pollution. We know a lot of the air pollution inside is caused by the air pollution outside. And so thinking about ways in which to make our schools have better indoor air quality, it's not specifically stemming from the findings per se, because we're not assessing indoor air quality, but it just is a good reminder to think about how we can try to keep pollution out of our schools or clean and filter the air inside.
Wow. Something we haven't touched on that I want to get to just before we wrap up here, because we're running low on time, is, you know, the current circumstances that we are living through. And on the show, in a moment, we're going to turn to a conversation about the decrease in air pollution in our region in general because of the pandemic. And I know that across the globe, the findings aren't the same everywhere you go. But we have seen a decrease in air pollution, at least in the month of March. In any case, do you have any thoughts about how, you know, using the terrible situation that we are living through right now might be a way to springboard into a better, into better outcomes? You know, like, look, we can see that there's measurable distinctions to be made when people stop driving and people behave a certain way, and of course are confined in very tragic circumstances. But is there a lesson for the kind of work that you're doing from the pandemic or not?
I am hopeful. I maybe, like you were saying, I am hopeful that our experiences of better air quality are a motivator, you know, for us to enact policy that will regulate our air pollution to a greater degree, or for people that are able to make the choice, you know, not to drive as much, to do more telecommuting, to have, you know, supervisors and managers and bosses that are more tolerant of telecommuting so we don't have to drive so much. So yeah, I am hopeful that this is a moment in which we experience better air quality and then might make changes to keep it that way. But also I think from this environmental justice perspective, we have to remember that not everyone is experiencing the same benefits in terms of, you know, reduced air quality, that there are still, you know, areas where they're experiencing higher levels than others, and that those are health harming. And so we just have to sort of keep up the momentum with regards to pollution reduction strategies.
Do you see that momentum? I mean, is there, are we seeing degrees of improvement happening to an extent that you think, yes, we are on the right path, or at least on a path of improved air quality?
We seem to be here locally, we seem to be on a path towards improved air quality. There's some nationally, and I think here as well, a little blip in 2018 of decreasing air quality again after, you know, many years of steady increases in our air quality, which people have connected to President Trump and sort of reduced protections in the environment. Hopefully that's just a little blip and we can continue to improve our air quality here in Salt Lake County. Certainly with the Utah roadmap, there's a lot of sort of people talking about how do we continue our improvements in air quality. So I'm hopeful that we can continue on that path.
Yeah, I frequently wonder, and this is not something that I think that you're necessarily looking at, but, you know, origins or sources of PM 2.5, and we're all kind of like, well, how much of it is from cars, how much of it is from buildings, how much of it is from industry? Do we have a good breakdown on that?
So the main sources of primary PM 2.5 in Salt Lake County during the winter are, in rank order, mobile sources such as vehicles, trains, or aircraft, smaller stationary sources like home heating, smoke from wood burning, and emissions from small shops and restaurants, as well as large industrial and commercial facilities. So there's also secondary PM, which comprises more than one half of the PM levels in the study. And this is just when there's chemical reactions between different chemicals in the atmosphere that also forms tiny particles, which are counted as part of the PM.
Okay. How about just in terms of anything we're missing from the study that you think we didn't talk about? I mean, the big picture is inequitable exposure to air pollution, that geographic stratification and socioeconomic status, some people having a much worse exposure to air pollution.
The only other thing maybe to add is just our use of the AQ&U data. And if anyone wants to try to get a sensor at their home, they can purchase one through the AQ&U or the Purple Air and have a sensor in their home that's part of the network. So the AQ&U website is a really good resource. You can go to it to check. I do this myself to check on, you know, what are the PM levels near my home? And if you see monitors in your area, you can actually apply to get one in your house so you can contribute to the network.
And what's that website?
AQANDU.org.
Sarah Gronowski, Professor of Sociology and Environmental Studies at the University of Utah, thank you again for joining me and for this really interesting paper and for explaining it to us.
You're welcome. Thank you for being interested.
And my apologies for some of the sound quality during that interview. It wasn't apparent during the recording that it was as choppy as it was. And as I just mentioned in my conversation with Dr. Gronowski, we are indeed seeing cleaner air, at least locally, because of the shutdown associated with the pandemic. I think we can all agree that a deadly virus is no way to clean up the air, but what can we learn about pollution and perhaps about cleaning it up from this unintentional air quality experiment? Yesterday, KCPW producer Tim Pierce checked in with someone we interviewed back in March. Logan Mitchell is a research assistant professor with the University of Utah's Department of Atmospheric Sciences. And he's been digging into what the data shows about just how much cleaner the air we breathe is when everything shuts down.
Last time you were on the show was back in March, and you were describing a sort of general image of the pandemic's impact on our regional air quality. But now you're back and with data. So can you give me a general gist of what you found?
So we're obviously very interested in how the COVID lockdown has affected our local air quality. And so I looked at the data from our local air quality monitoring sites. And one interesting thing is that usually in March and April, we have generally pretty good air quality in Utah. And so initially I wasn't sure if we would see much at all. But even though there is generally good air quality, as we reduce emissions, our air quality could get even better. And so that's exactly what we found. Looking at the different pollutants that we measure along the Wasatch Front, especially nitrogen oxides, were much lower. And the time of day when those are low really point to a reduction in traffic emissions, which we know from, you know, the Department of Transportation has, you know, they count cars, and we could see a large decrease in the number of cars on the road. And, you know, that is really showing up in these, in the monitor data sets. And so we have surface observations that are showing this dramatic signal. And I also looked at satellite imagery to see if that agreed with what the surface sites were saying, and it does. And again, the signal is really dramatic. And, you know, the satellite imagery exists for the whole world. And so there's been a lot of discussion about that in the news media, but it's really neat to be able to look at surface air quality sites and see the same signal in the satellite data sets. And then another thing that's really unique to what we're doing here is we have CO2 monitoring sites that are measuring the greenhouse gases across Salt Lake City. And so I looked at that data as well. And again, it shows really consistent pattern of reduced emissions during the COVID lockdown.
So you're saying reduced emissions, but can you paint a picture of how much or what that actually looks like for our listeners back home?
Yeah, we're seeing a dramatic reduction in air pollutants, anywhere from 40 to 60% better in terms of nitrogen dioxide. And that is those nitrogen oxides are a key pollutant that contribute to ozone and particulates. Ozone is a pollutant that we're worried about in the summertime, and particulates is what causes our air quality to be bad in the wintertime. And there's really fascinating inner reactions or interplay with the atmospheric chemistry in the valley too. So all of these pollutants are kind of come together and affect air quality in different ways. And also we're seeing the same sort of reduction in greenhouse gases that are contributing to the change in climate that, you know, affect our water supply, heat stress, and winter recreation, all of those sorts of things.
So we know there's a dramatic, close-knit relationship between vehicle point sources and air quality, right? So fewer polluting vehicles directly correlates to improved air quality, seemingly exponentially, yeah? But what is this data really showing about the Wasatch Front, and are there any changes that people living in the Wasatch Front could be making?
Well, what it's showing is that our air quality is really dependent on our emissions, and there's a really immediate cause and effect there, which, you know, as a scientist, I know and I can, you know, I can talk about in classes and we can, you know, model it, but it's another thing to actually see it played out in the real world, to see emissions go down and the very, you know, the next day, the next couple of days, the next week, to see air quality all of a sudden get dramatically better, even when the air quality is already pretty good. Like, how much better could it get? And it's noticeable how the air quality has improved. And so that's great for us here in March and April. You know, and obviously a global pandemic is a terrible way to improve air quality because of the huge impacts on our economy and health. But what I see is this really points a way to the future. You know, as we build out of the pandemic, can we rebuild our economy and our energy infrastructure in a way that is better for health, that can capture some of these gains permanently, rather than having it be a result of, you know, a pandemic where there's 50% of people who can't drive? You know, can we convert more vehicles to electric so that those emissions won't exist? Can we do more telecommuting and things like that to reduce some of the traffic emissions? Can we convert some buildings to, you know, electricity so they're not burning natural gas? All of those things would really improve our local air quality.
I think right now, with this dramatic cause and effect of fewer vehicles resulting in better air quality, that really puts Utah in this unique position. Because improved air quality is a tangible reality. We see it. We literally breathe the results, right? But what really does that transition into reducing more polluting vehicles or, you know, shifting into using renewable energy actually look like? Especially considering that coal and petroleum and natural gas is so ingrained into all of these different facets of our lives and culture and society.
There's no doubt that this energy transition is going to be challenging and there are going to be bumps along the road. And, you know, to be realistic, there are vested interests that have built their businesses around the current energy system. And it's going to be challenging for those folks in those communities that rely on those jobs to transition. I mean, it's going to be a challenging time, this transition. The Chemgartner Policy Institute also has an effort to look at some of these transitions and figure out positive and productive ways through them. There's the efforts called the Coal Country Strike Team. And they're working on with communities in Price that are really dependent around the coal manufacturing or production and electricity production, and looking at how those communities could transition. I mean, I am personally very thankful that they have provided electricity for the state of Utah for decades that has really enabled the economic growth of the country. I would like those communities to be taken care of. I don't think it is right to just transition, cut out the base of those communities and just let them flounder. So I think it's responsible, and it's responsible policy to take care of those communities. But the reality is that there is going to be these challenges. But another way of thinking about it is we're in a global competition for the future energy system. And we could decide that it's too hard, we need to go real slow, and the jobs and innovations for the new energy economy are then going to be created in China or Germany or somewhere else, and we will miss out on that. And so, I mean, I think that it's important to understand both sides of that equation. There is a transition and it's going to be difficult, but if we don't do it and if we sit on our laurels and don't take initiative, we're going to miss out on a massive economic opportunity. And I think that would be a missed opportunity for the state of Utah.
And again, that was Logan Mitchell, a research assistant professor with the U of U's Department of Atmospheric Sciences, speaking with KCPW producer Tim Pierce. We'd love to hear your thoughts on air quality in the time of coronavirus. More than a few people have commented on social media about being able to see further than they remember seeing, or that the viewshed is generally better because of the pandemic. But then again, at what cost? You can add your own comments to KCPW's Facebook page, where we'll shortly post this show. And again, you've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, independent public radio resource. Find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once more for joining us. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.